Good day, everyone, and welcome to the Plunkett and Cooney Misclassifying Workers, Pitfalls and Penalties for Employers webinar. If you're having technical issues during the call, please press star zero. Today's conference is being recorded. I would now like to turn the conference over to Mr. John Cornwell. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is John Cornwell, and I'm Plunkett Cooney's Practice Development Manager. I have the pleasure of coordinating today's webinar, and just let me begin by saying how very happy we are to have all of you with us here today. Before we get started, I want to provide you with some background about our firm. Plunkett Cooney is based in Southeast Michigan and is one of the Midwest's leading commercial law firms with more than 160 attorneys in 9 Michigan cities and one each in Columbus, Ohio and Indianapolis, Indiana. Our labor and employment practice group currently includes more than 20 attorneys who practice primarily in the areas of traditional labor law, human resources consulting, and employment litigation. Many of our attorneys are recognized leaders in these areas of practice. Our Informed Employer webinar series is designed to keep human resource professionals, risk managers, and business executives updated on the ever-changing legal landscape and to provide you with HR best practices as well as to discuss trends in workforce management. Today's webinar has been approved for 1.25 general recertification credit hours toward PHR, SPHR, and GPHR recertification through the HR Certification Institute. Following today's presentation, a certificate of completion will be emailed to each of you reflecting that credit. If you do not need the HRCI credit, please simply disregard that certificate and that email. Participating in today's discussion are two attorneys from Plunkett Cooney's Labor and Employment Practice Group, Claudia Orr and Laura Dinan, and I'll start with a little introduction about each. A member of Plunkett Cooney's Detroit office, Ms. Orr is one of the firm's most experienced employment law attorneys. She's had the distinction of representing a variety of employers ranging in size from Fortune 500 companies to mid-size and even small businesses. Ms. Orr advises employers on all aspects of employment law and defends their interests when litigation and administrative issues arise. She's a member of the Board of Directors of the Human Resource Association of Greater Detroit, and she's the past chair of the HRAGD Legal Affairs Committee. Laura Dinan is an employment law attorney in Plunkett Cooney's Petoskey, Michigan office with over 20 years of experience advising employers. Ms. Dinan has built a successful practice with emphasis on traditional labor and employment law. Her clients include public and private sector employers of all sizes throughout northern Michigan. She provides human resource advice on a range of issues, including policy and procedure development, handbook updates, workforce management consulting, and dispute resolution services, including representation of employers during litigation, administrative hearings, and labor negotiations up to and through arbitration. Ms. Dinan currently serves as Vice President of the Board of Directors of the Northern Michigan Society of Human Resource Directors. And now a couple of housekeeping notes I wanted to cover today. If you're attempting to log into our webinar provider, startvisuals.com, and are having any difficulties, just be sure to turn off your pop-up blocker software. And if you have any problems further than that, again, press zero and star, and our operator will assist you. Due to the volume of callers attending today's session and the amount of material we're going to try to cover here, we have requested that anyone who wishes to ask questions be placed into an operator-assisted question queue. At the end of our webinar, our presenters will take as many questions as time permits, and our operator will provide you with instructions for entering the question queue during the Q&A portion of the program. The operator will basically announce your name and company affiliation and then open your line so that you can ask your question for the benefit of everyone on the call today. Please note that today's session is being recorded, and both the audio file and presentation slides will be available on Plunkett Cooney's website, which is located at plunkettcooney.com. Once again, on behalf of the firm, thank you for attending today's webinar. And now I will turn over the program to our featured speakers, Claudia Orr and Laura Dinan. And I believe, Laura, you are up first.
Yes, thanks, John. Claudia and I are going to cover the exemptions under the Fair Labor Standards Act, but we decided that a good refresher leading into that would be talking about the difference between an independent contractor and an employee, and then once you know that you have employees and who they are, you can go through the test to determine if they're exempt or non-exempt. So I'm going to start with the independent contractor issue. in the last few years, the state and federal agencies have really ramped up their audits, and they're looking closely at anybody who you classify as an independent contractor. They've discovered that it's a really good source of revenue, that many, many hundreds of millions of dollars are left on the table by these independent contractors, both because employers don't pay their payroll taxes and the independent contractors don't always pay their income taxes. So the IRS, the Department of Labor, and even Michigan's Unemployment Agency are aggressively going after employers who pay wages as independent contractor income rather than employee wages. A big thing that you should know and be concerned about, if you are a recipient of an inquiry from the unemployment agency or the IRS or the Department of Labor, they are all information sharing. So if one of them comes in and starts looking at your relationships, you can be a little worried that more than one is going to show up on your doorstep. There are three primary tests used depending on which agency is involved to determine whether individuals are independent contractors or employees. You have to assume that any government agency that's looking at these relationships is going to start with the premise that the individual is an employee unless the employer can prove otherwise. The three tests that are commonly used are the common law control test, the economic reality test, and the IRS 20-factor test. The control test arises out of agency law, and it's applied in Michigan when respondeat superior liability has been claimed. They look at the following factors to consider in determining whether an individual is an agent of the principal, i.e., an employee. They look at the extent of control, which by agreement the master may exercise over the details of the work, whether or not the one employed is engaged in a distinct occupation or business, the kind of occupation, with reference to whether in the locality the work is usually done under the direction of the employer or the work is usually done by a specialist without supervision. They also look at the skill required in the particular occupation, whether the employer or the worker supplies the tools, the place of work for the person doing the work. They look at the length of time for which the person is employed, the method of payment, whether by the time or by the job, whether the work is part of the regular business of the employer, whether the parties believe they're creating the relationship of master and servant, and whether the principal is or is not in business. Michigan generally uses the economic reality test for determining statutory and contractual use of the term employee. For example, this test is applied to test whether an individual is a covered employee under the Workers' Compensation Act, the Whistleblower Protection Act, and the Civil Rights Act. The elements of employee status under the economic reality test are control of the worker's duties, payment of wages, the right to hire, fire, and discipline, and performance of the duties towards the accomplishment of a common goal. The economic reality test uses eight factors. They look at what liability, if any, does the employer incur in the event of the termination of the relationship at will. Is the work being performed an integral part of the employer's business, which contributes to the accomplishment of a common objective? Is the position or job of such a nature that the employee primarily depends upon the compensation for the job for payment of his living expenses, i.e., is it their primary source of income? Does the employee furnish his own equipment and materials? They also look at, does the individual seeking employment hold himself out to the public as one ready and able to perform tasks of a given nature? Is the work or undertaking in question customarily performed by people as an independent contractor? Control is a factor to be considered along with payment of wages, maintenance of discipline, and the right to engage or discharge employees. Weight is given to those factors which will most favorably effectuate the objectives of the statute. In other words, they give more weight to the things that will make the person an employee rather than an independent contractor. The IRS has its own test, which the Department of Labor also uses for analyzing whether someone is an independent contractor or an employee. This test looks at 20 factors to distinguish an employee from an independent contractor. The courts and the IRS look to the actual relationship the individual has with the employer in making the determination. They'll look at a contract, but it doesn't really matter what you call it. They go beyond the contract and they look at what's actually going on, what the relationship is between the two parties. They start with the written agreement and see if you have an express provision in it calling it an independent contractor relationship or an employment agreement. And I have seen situations where it will purportedly be an independent contractor agreement, but then all the way through the document it talks about employees. In that situation, they're an employee. They don't care what the heading is. A court might find that the agreement's characterization of the relationship as an independent contractor is not dispositive. They may employ a totality of the circumstances or an economic reality test to determine whether they're an independent contractor or an employee. They consider such factors as control of the worker's duties, payment of wages, right to hire, fire, and discipline, and performance of duties constituting an integral part of the employee's business. Under the totality of the circumstances test, no one factor controls. Everything is reviewed together. The IRS examines the following 20 factors. Whether the business entity retains the right to require the worker to comply with instructions, whether the business entity trains the worker, whether the worker's services are essential, which would indicate they're an employee, or ancillary to the business, and that would be indicating a contractor, whether the services must be rendered personally by the worker, whether the worker can hire, supervise, and pay assistance, which would indicate a contractor, whether a continuing relationship exists between the worker and the business entity, that would indicate an employee, whether the business entity requires the worker to work set hours, which would indicate an employee, whether the worker is required to devote him or herself full-time to performing services to that business entity, which would indicate an employee, whether the worker is required to work on the business premises, which indicates an employee, whether the business establishes the order or sequence of work, again indicating an employee, whether the worker is required to give oral or written reports, that would be an employee, and whether the worker is paid by the hour, week, or month indicates that they would be an employee. They also look at whether the worker must pay his or her own business expenses, which would indicate they're a contractor, whether the worker supplies his or her own equipment, again indicating they're a contractor, whether the worker has made a substantial investment in the facilities of the business entity, that indicates a contractor, and whether the worker realizes profit or loss, that again indicates they would be a contractor. Whether the worker provides services for more than one business entity at a time indicates they're a contractor. Whether the worker makes his or her service available to the public indicates they would be a contractor. Whether the business entity retains the right to discharge the worker, which would indicate they have an employer-employee relationship. And whether the worker has the right to terminate the relationship at any time without incurring liability, which would indicate they're an employee. Again, no factor is dispositive under these tests, but the right to control and the presence of worker investment emerge as two of the most significant factors they look at. Generally, the IRS will consider the individual an employee, and the unemployment agency takes the same approach. A good analogy is somebody who you hire to put a roof on your building. You bring them in, they have trained their own employees, they bring their own equipment, they bring their own supplies, they go up on your roof, and their only instruction from you is to put a new roof on the building, and you're going to pay them when they finish putting the roof on. That's a true independent contractor situation. Their duties do not have anything to do with the primary purpose of your business. They're there to perform a set job, they're going to get paid, and they're going to leave. That's the type of classification that the IRS or these other agencies would view as legitimately an independent contractor. And obviously there's a lot of things that fall in between, but that's an easy example to see the kinds of things that make them independent. Moving on, under the wage and hour provisions of the Fair Labor Standards Act, the Department of Labor deems a worker an independent contractor if he or she provides service to the business entity in the course of an independent occupation and if the business entity controls only the results of the work but not the means by which the work is accomplished. Another factor that the government relies on to claim that an individual is an employee, not an independent contractor, is they look to see whether they participate in your benefit plans. Generally, an ERISA benefit plan, a health care plan, a 401k, a pension plan, they only allow employees to participate. So if you have someone you're calling an independent contractor and they're participating in your benefit plans, they're employees. It doesn't matter what you call them. And again, if they're excluded from your benefit plans, then they may very well be an independent contractor. It's not the determinative factor, but it's a factor that the government will look at. I've had situations where an employer will employ someone in a particular occupation and then they will want them to do additional work on the side and call them an independent contractor. That does not fly. If they're actually an employee, they're going to be an employee no matter what they're doing for you. The Department of Labor will not buy that argument. An independent contractor can't be an independent contractor for some jobs and an employee for others, for most things. Now, if the guy has a roofing business on the side and you hire him to put on a roof, he's probably an independent contractor for that job, but in general, that doesn't work. Michigan's Bed Employment Agency has its own definition of independent contractor for purposes of determining who's an employee. That's a different definition than the one used by the IRS or the work comp system. And as you can guess, the unemployment agency definition is much more comprehensive than some of the other governmental agencies. MCL 421.42 states that to be considered employment subject to the Act, an individual's services must be under the employer's control or direction as to the performance of the services, both under a contract for hire and in fact. Evidence that an employee or an individual is separately established in the particular trade or business, preferably incorporated in some form, is essential to establish independent contractor status. Paying individuals on a project or project completion basis rather than a salary or hourly rate also helps to establish that they're an independent contractor. And finally, some helpful things to keep in mind when trying to establish an independent contractor relationship are that while a written contract isn't legally conclusive, it's a really good idea if you are trying to establish an independent contractor relationship to have a written agreement up front, and that forces you to plan and structure the relationship before they do any work for you so you can tailor it to meet the criteria to establish them as an independent contractor. You may not be able to make them an independent contractor under all 20 points of the IRS test, but if you establish that they can meet most of them, you'll have a much better shot at classifying them as an independent contractor rather than an employee. The evidence that the individual is separately established in the particular trade or business is very helpful to establishing independent contractor status. Paying them on a project or project completion basis rather than salary or hourly. If you can show that they advertise their business or do work for other entities, those are all really, really helpful in establishing independent contractor status. In sum, the main factor of all the tests is control. if the employer has the right to control the when, the where, and the how of the work, they're probably an employee. Well, now that you know who your employees are, Claudia is going to cover classifying employees as exempt or non-exempt.
Thank you, Laura. As Laura indicated, the law presumes that the worker is an employee. And similarly, under the Fair Labor Standards Act and also the Michigan law, the law is going to assume that the individual should be paid on an hourly basis, is a non-exempt employee, and is entitled to overtime. And it's going to be your burden as an employer to properly classify and convince the Department of Labor that you've properly classified the employee as an exempt employee. And in the Sixth Circuit, this has to be shown by clear and affirmative evidence. It's not just tipping of the scale in your favor. You have to come forward with clear and affirmative evidence to prove that this person was properly classified as an exempt employee. And so exempt versus non-exempt, that's the question for this part. There's numerous exemptions that are possible. Some of the less common exemptions are processing sugar beets, sugar beet molasses, maple syrup, or syrup. Also employees who sell certain recreational vehicles and work in certain auto repair shops. Taxi drivers, people who are domestic servants who actually reside in the household. Employees who work at a motion picture theater, certain agricultural employees, including those who work on cotton gins. Seamen. They should also say sea women, but this was written back in the 1920s. Buyers of poultry, eggs, cream, and milk. You can picture the guy pulling up in his horse-drawn carriage selling the eggs from the farm. And there's others, but those aren't the ones we're going to focus on today. We're going to focus on the primary exemptions, which are, the executive, which includes employee owners, professionals, administrative, outside sales, high-level computer employees, highly compensated employees, and please note that if a person is a blue-collar worker or they're performing manual tasks with their hands or if they're rescue workers, they cannot be an exempt employee. The reason this matters is because an employer is required to pay time and a half for all hours actually worked over 40. So if you've not been paying them time and a half for all hours worked over 40 hours in a work week, the person must be exempt or you're going to face significant liability. And again, the exemptions are very narrowly construed, and it's your burden to prove that you've met the exemption. In April 2004, new regulations were approved, which redefined some of the major exemptions. And as I previously indicated, if the person is an emergency or rescue worker, such as police officers, firefighters, paramedics, EMTs, ambulance personnel, regardless of the rank or amount of pay, they cannot be exempt. If the worker prevents, controls, or extinguishes fires, rescue victims of fires, crimes, or accidents, prevents, detects, or investigates crimes, apprehends, detains, interviews, processes, or supervises convicts or criminals, they're entitled to receive overtime. Let's look at the executive exemption. What I'm going to discuss on the PowerPoint slides are the general rules, what the test is, the actual test. And then after I've reviewed the general rule for each of the exemptions, I'm going to go back and fill in the blanks and give you a little bit more detail on what some of those terms are. So for the executive exemption, and these are people who are generally viewed as managers, the general rule is that they must be paid on a salary basis at the rate of not less than $455 a week, and that cannot include any value you take for board, lodging, or other facilities like health clubs, that the primary duty consists of the management of the enterprise or of a customarily recognized department or subdivision, and that the employee, these are all ends, and that the employee customarily and regularly directs the work of at least two employees, and that the employee have the authority to hire or fire, other employees, or at least have his recommendation concerning hiring and firing and promotions and things of that type, be given particular weight. Now, what do these terms mean? First of all, the exclusive of board lodging or other facilities means that it has to be, when you're calculating the $455 a week, it's free and clear, independent of any claim credit for those that the value of those non-cash items. So you can't include that. Also, note that the executive exemption, which is the management exemption, requires that the employee be paid on a salary basis. The other exemptions I'm going to cover, the administrative exemption and professional exemption, allow the employee to be paid on a fee basis, which means that you're paying them for a particular project or activity. So, for example, under the professional exemption, you could have a doctor that you've hired, and you're going to pay him on a fee basis. So for every evaluation or examination of a patient that the doctor does, you pay him $50 for the visit. It could be something like that. But the executive exemption requires on a salary basis, which means that they're basically going to get the same agreed-upon amount week in and week out, regardless of the quality or quantity of their work. And there are a lot of exceptions to that, but that's not what this seminar is about today. We're looking at classifying. When we're looking at the management duties, which include activities such as interviewing, selecting, and training of employees. Again, this is the primary duty of the manager. You're interviewing, selecting, and training employees. You're setting and adjusting their rates of pay and hours of work. You're directing the work of employees. You're appraising employees' productivity. You're handling employee complaints and grievances. You're disciplining employees. And you're apportioning the work among the employees. These are the kind of duties that must be the primary duty of the executive to be exempt. Also, when you're looking at it being the primary duty, note that the employee could actually be doing some non-exempt work concurrently, and that won't automatically disqualify the employee from the executive exemption. So, for example, an assistant manager in a retail establishment may perform work such as serving customers or stocking the shelves and cleaning the establishment, but the performance of that non-exempt work will not preclude the exemption if the assistant manager's primary duty is management. However, if you're looking at a relief supervisor or a working supervisor whose primary duty is to perform the non-exempt work, that person will not become exempt merely because he occasionally has some responsibility for directing the work of other employees. Also, when we talk about having to direct the work of at least two employees, we're talking about two or more full-time equivalent employees. So, for example, the manager could have one full-time employee working for him and two half-time employees, and that would be the equivalency of two full-time employees. Here's a little tip. You could have two supervisors who actually share the responsibility of the same two full-time employees, and that will satisfy the requirement. However, if a full-time employee works 20 hours a week for one supervisor and then 20 hours a week for a different supervisor, each supervisor only gets credit for a half-time employee. So it actually has to be a shared responsibility and not splitting up the hourly employee's work, 20 hours for one supervisor and 20 for the other. But where there's a shared responsibility for the supervision of the same two employees, both of those supervisors can take credit for the employee. And finally, how we also mentioned that the person had to have the authority to hire or and fire or have their recommendations be given particular weight. Particular weight means that you should consider whether it's part of that employee's job duties to make such recommendations and suggestions. Look at the frequency with which such recommendations and suggestions are made or that you're requesting those recommendations. And also the frequency with which the employee's suggestions and recommendations are actually acted upon. The suggestions and recommendations for hiring and firing, by the way, generally must pertain to the employees that the individual supervises. So that's the test for the executive exemption. There is the employer-owner executive, and this is an individual who owns at least 20% equity interest in the enterprise and is actively engaged in the management. And when that happens, there are no salary requirements for the employee-owner under the executive exemption, and, of course, there's no overtime either. Moving on to the administrative exemption, and this is one that I see being abused quite often or confused. So, again, let's review the general rule. What does the test require? In this case, they can be paid on a salary. And by the way, this is the administrator. For example, a human resources professional would be an executive exemption if they have the right duties. Or the office administrator who doesn't actually manage people but administers a type of work being performed, a function. So the general rule is, again, that this person could be paid on a salary or, in this case, a fee basis at the rate of not less than $455 a week, exclusive of board, lodging, and other facilities, and that the primary work consists of office or non-manual work, which is directly related to the management or general business operations of the employer, and whose primary duty includes the exercise of discretion and independent judgment with respect to significant matters. This is not a light test, and we're going to come back to that, because that's where most employers go wrong in their analysis. When it comes to what kind of work that's directly related to management or general business operations, this refers to the type of work that's performed by the employee. And to meet this requirement, the employee must perform work directly related to assisting with the running of the business. Such functional areas as accounting, human resources, public relations, or similar activities. Quite often you view these as the back office kind of functions. Or it can be the same kind of work, but for the customer. So if an employee is acting as an advisor or consultant to a client or customer, such as a tax expert or financial consultant, that may also qualify. The discretion and independent judgment. This is where you really have to take a hard look at the employee before you say, yep, they're an administrative exempt employee. Listen to the words, and I'll emphasize those that seem to be where employers kind of skim over it and they miss the test. This involves the comparison and the evaluation of possible courses of conduct and acting or making a decision after the various possibilities have been considered. You see, the employee actually has some discretion there. The term matters of significance refers to the level of importance or the consequences of the work performed. So it's got to be involving matters that are of significance. Factors to consider are whether the employee has authority to formulate, affect, interpret, or implement management policies or operating practices, whether the employee carries out major assignments in conducting the operations of the business, whether the employee performs work that affects business operations to a substantial degree. Even if the employee's assignments are related to the operation of a particular segment, also note that whether the employee has authority to commit the employer in matters that have significant financial impact, whether the employee has authority to waive or deviate from the established policies and procedures without prior approval. So you see, this is someone who basically can call the shots, deviate from established practices and procedures, and make very important decisions binding the company. So this is not someone that you can, this is not an exemption that applies to a lot of high-ranking people. You may not want to give the employee that kind of autonomy or that kind of authority. Whereas with the manager employee, the executive exemption, you can tweak up their job a little bit. You can assign them the receptionist, so now they've got two full-time equivalent employees working for them. And you can have, you know, instead of one employee, you can have two, and that helps satisfy it. And you can really lean on them and listen to their recommendations about hiring and firing and promotions and so on. That's not quite as scary as giving an employee the kind of level of discretion and autonomy that the administrative exemption requires. Going back to the administrative exemption, the fact that an employee's decision may be subject to review and that upon occasion the decisions are revised or reversed after review doesn't mean that the employee is not exercising discretion and independent judgment. Remember, that should only be happening on occasion. However, for employees who simply apply well-established techniques or procedures that are described in manuals or other sources or kind of within your policies and guidelines or within closely prescribed limits to determine the correct response to an inquiry or a set of circumstances, these are not exempt employees. They're just applying the policies and practices that you have. The exercise of discretion and judgment cannot include mere clerical or secretarial work, recording or tabulating, gathering data, performing other repetitive, recurrent, or routine work. This person has to have a lot of authority and responsibility. The executive assistant or administrative assistant to the business owner or the top executive of a large business can qualify, though, if the employee, without specific instructions or prescribed procedures, has been delegated the authority regarding matters of significance. This is, for example, look at a family business. The owner of the company, and it's grown. He's had the same secretary working for him for 20 years. He trusts her decision. He's come to rely on her significantly in matters. And everybody knows when the boss is gone, you can go to her and she can call the shots. That's the kind of administrative executive or the administrative assistant that I just described. Some of the kinds of workers that this will sometimes apply to are the human resources managers, which I know your ears are perking up. They will qualify if they formulate, interpret, or implement employment policies, but personnel clerks who screen applicants or obtain data regarding minimum qualifications and fitness for employment generally would not meet the duties requirements for the administrative exemption. So you see, we're talking about the level of autonomy, the level of decision-making authority, the discretion that's involved has to be fairly significant in order to qualify. And when in doubt, the person should be paid on an hourly basis and classified as non-exempt. All right, let's look at the professional exemption. The general rule for the professional exemption is that they can be paid on a salary or fee basis, $455 a week, inclusive of board, lodging, other facilities. But the primary duty, and there's two types here we're going to cover, the primary duty will consist of work requiring knowledge of an advanced type in a field of science or learning customarily acquired by a prolonged course of specialized intellectual instruction. We're not talking about, you know, bachelor's of general studies, something like that. Or, and those are the learned professionals, or there's the artist exception, which is requiring invention, imagination, or originality or talent in a recognized field of artistic or creative endeavor. Let's start with the learned professional. When we're looking at work requiring advanced knowledge, we're looking at work which is predominantly intellectual in character and which includes work requiring the consistent exercise of discretion and judgment as distinguished from performance of routine mental work. An employee who performs work requiring advanced knowledge generally uses the advanced knowledge to analyze, interpret, or make deductions from varying facts or circumstances. So, for example, a skilled tradesperson, where in some instance the knowledge is a fairly advanced type, but it's not in a field of science or learning, that person is not exempt. Learned professionals will include such things as professionals in medicine, theology, accounting, actuarial, computation, engineering, agriculture, teaching, and various types of physical, chemical, and biological sciences, and pharmacy. The learned professional exemption is not available for occupations that customarily may be performed with only the general knowledge acquired by an academic degree in any field. So, for example, if you're just saying, you know, we prefer someone with a bachelor's degree, but it's not a bachelor's degree in nuclear science or something like that, it's got to be a specific degree that lends itself to that job. And they've got to be operating. For example, I have a JD, which is the Juris Doctorate for attorneys. But if I go work at Target or Walmart as a greeter, I'm not using my degree. And just because I have that degree, I can't be treated as an exempt employee doing that job. So it's got to be the job requiring the degree, and you got to have the right degree. When we talk about the kind that's customarily acquired by a prolonged course of specialized intellectual instruction, this restricts the learned professional exemption to professions where specialized academic training is a standard prerequisite for entering into the profession. And the best evidence that an employee meets this requirement is having the appropriate academic degree. However, the word customarily means that the exemption may also be available to employees in such professions who have substantially the same knowledge level and perform substantially the same work as the degreed employees, but who attain the advanced knowledge through a combination of work experience and intellectual instruction. So in other words, it's possible that some engineers can be grandfathered in. But you should be very cautious when you're looking at making the exception because, again, the burden is on you. So let's see how this plays out in the real world. Nurses who are RNs are exempt. However, an LPN or a licensed practical nurse will not qualify. The difference is RNs have to go to school for 4 years. LPNs get a 2-year degree. Dental hygienists qualify only if they have successfully completed 4 academic years of pre-professional and professional study. Accountants will qualify if they are CPAs, but if they're accounting clerks, bookkeepers, payroll and such, or some other kind of employee who normally performs a great deal of routine work, they're not going to qualify as exempt. Chefs may qualify if they are executive chefs or sous chefs who have attained a 4-year specialized academic degree in a culinary arts program, but cooks who perform predominantly routine manual work will not qualify. So neither the general rule for professional employees nor the salary requirements will apply to the legal or medical professionals. The law and medical professionals require them to have a valid license permitting it, or certificate permitting the practice of law or medicine or any of their branches and is actually engaged in the practice, and an employee who is the holder of the requisite academic degree, so again, teachers, or for the general practice of medicine and is engaged in an internship or residence. So there can be interns and residents who will qualify for the exemption even though they haven't completed their study. So generally when it comes to people in the legal or medical fields, the rule is work them hard and work them long, and you don't have to abide by the salary levels or anything else. You know, that's how it applies. All right, now let's look at the creative professionals. which is one more category of the professionals. Teaching is, you know, you're a teacher, and you've got the right education, you're, and the right certificate. But the creative professionals, these are people whose primary duty must be the performance of work requiring invention, imagination, originality, talent. And also the work must be in a recognized field of artistic or creative endeavor. So the duties of an employee who qualifies for the artistic professional exemption is someone whose profession, creative profession, depends on the extent of the invention, imagination, originality, or talent that's exercised by the employee. And this requirement generally is met by actors, musicians, composers, conductors, painters, and we're not talking about painters of barns. We're talking about those who are given the subject matter, and then they use their talents to create an art piece of art. Cartoonists who are merely told the title or underlining concept of a cartoon. They're not just drawing a character over and over. Novelists, screenplay writers who choose their own subject and hand in a finished piece of work. And some people who hold the more responsible writing positions in advertising agencies. Journalists may satisfy his, or show you the difference between someone who's truly creative. A journalist may satisfy the duties requirements for the creative professional exemption if their primary duty is work requiring invention, imagination, originality, or talent. But if they're an employee of a newspaper, magazine, television, or other media, and they're only collecting, organizing, recording information that is routine or already made public, they're not going to be exempt. So the news reporter is not exempt, but the person who's writing very artistic stories in the newspaper, they would be. So that runs through the three primary professional exemption, executive exemption, and the administrative exemption. I'm going to turn it back over to Laura, who's going to talk about a couple more exemptions.
Thanks, Claudia. There's an exemption for highly compensated employees that could fall under the executive, administrative, or professional exemptions, but for some reason don't. If they are paid over $100,000 a year, they may be exempt as a highly compensated employee. There's a new short test that was developed with the changes in 2004. This test requires that they're paid compensation on a salary or fee basis of not less than $455 a week, and the $100,000 may be a combination of salary, commissions, and other non-discretionary bonuses and compensation, and it must be paid in full within 1 month after the end of the calendar year. So if they're paid $100,000 over the year and receive at least $455 a week, and they receive the entire amount of compensation in the calendar year, they meet the first part of that test. It also requires that the employee customarily and regularly perform one or more of the exempt duties or responsibilities of an executive, administrative, or professional employee. And the good thing about that test is that they only have to perform one of the duties or responsibilities. They could do more, but, for instance, if they customarily and regularly direct the work of two or more employees, they don't have to meet any of the other requirements of the executive exemption. The compensation has to be, we talked about that, paid on a salary or fee basis at a rate of not less than $455 a week, or they can be, I'm into the next exemption. I'm really sorry. We are actually moving on to a computer employee exemption. This is a newer exemption than the original ones that came out with the Fair Labor Standard Act originally. It's been around for quite a few years, but this is a little difficult to apply, and you have to be very careful because we'll go through the test, but there is an exemption for computer employees. It requires that they get compensated on a salary or fee basis, not less than $455 a week, or they can be paid at least $27.63 an hour if they're paid on an hourly basis. So that's one of the few exemptions where you can actually pay on an hourly basis, and they could be exempt. It requires that their primary duty consists of the application of systems analysis techniques and procedures, including consulting with users to determine hardware, software, or system functional specifications. Employees that are engaged in the manufacture or repair of computer hardware and related equipment, or whose work is highly dependent upon or facilitated by the use of computers and computer software programs, but who are not primarily engaged in computer systems analysis and programming, or other similarly skilled computer-related occupations, are not exempt. So some engineers, drafters, and others that use computer-aided design software will not be exempt. They have to really be involved in system analysis and programming or other skilled computer-related occupations as opposed to just using software. The test also requires as a primary duty that they design, development, documentation, analysis, creation, testing, or modification of computer systems or programs, including prototypes based on and related to user or system design specs, and the design, documentation, testing, creation, or modification of computer programs related to machine operating systems, or a combination of the above duties. Again, computer employees that actually do system analysis will be exempt, but people who just use the systems, even if they are engineers, are probably not going to fall under this exemption. Computer employees could, though, also have executive and administrative duties, which would qualify them under those exemptions. They may not fall under the computer employee exemption, but they may hold a position that would meet the executive or administrative duties. So don't forget to look at other exemptions. If you have an employee who you think should be exempt and they don't fall under the exemption you first looked at, move on to another one because they may qualify under that one. And finally, there's an exemption for outside salespeople. An outside salesman exemption applies to an employee whose primary duty is making sales or obtaining orders or contracts for services or for the use of facilities for which a consideration will be paid for by a client or customer, and who is customarily and regularly engaged away from the employer's place of business in performing the primary duty. And it's really important to know that this is geared to an employee who is on the road making sales. If they work one or two days in your facility and then they hit the road, they're probably not going to qualify. If they work out of their house, they're not going to qualify. The Department of Labor views that as just a home office situation. They have to actually be on the road going to their customers and making these sales. The primary duty requirement includes work performed incidental to and in conjunction with the employee's own outside sales or solicitations, including incidental deliveries and collections, and they can still be regarded as exempt outside salesmen. For example, a company representative who visits chain stores, arranges the merchandise on shelves, replenishes stock by replacing old with new merchandise, sets up displays and consults with the store manager when inventory runs low, but who's not there to obtain a commitment for additional purchases, would not be exempt under this outside sales exemption. Promotional work actually performed incidental to and in conjunction with an employee's own outside sales or solicitations is exempt work. So if you have got somebody who is out selling product and they've got a special promotion going and they go into the grocery store and help set up a Coke display or a Pepsi display, they're still going to be exempt because their primary purpose is to go there to sell product to that store. But if they're not the person who does the sales, if they just get the order, load the truck, and go deliver it, they are not going to be exempt. A factor to consider includes a comparison of the driver's duties with those of other employees engaged as truck drivers and salespersons, possession of a selling or solicitor's license when a license is required by law or ordinances, the presence or absence of customary or contractual arrangements concerning amounts of products to be delivered, a description of the employee's occupation and collective bargaining agreements, the employer's specifications as to qualifications for hiring, sales training, attendance at sales conferences, method of payment, and the proportion of earnings directly attributable to sales. An outside salesperson is an employee who makes sales at the customer's place of business or at the customer's home if they're doing door-to-door. It doesn't include sales by mail, telephone, or the Internet unless such contact is used merely to set up your personal call at the outside customer's place of business. So if you're at home or an office, again, it's used as your headquarters, you're not going to be an outside salesperson unless you actually leave the home and go to the customer's facility. And that wraps up all of the exemptions that we are going to talk about today. And I think Claudia is going to fill you in on some of the penalties when you misclassify employees.
So the question becomes, why should you care? It's because of the consequences. If you're wrong, you don't have to just pay them back their back pay, which it's like, well, if all I had to do was pay them what I had to pay anyhow, what the heck, I might as well see if I can get away with it. No, that's not it. In addition to back pay, you would pay attorney's fees, and we're not cheap. And in addition to that, if it's found to be willful violation, which quite often it is, then you have to pay twice the amount in back pay as liquidated damages. And if there's a second willful offense, you might be wearing stripes. You might be in prison. So the consequences can be fairly significant. And not only if an employee goes down to the Department of Labor and complains, not only will the Department of Labor look at that employee, but if they find that you misclassified that employee, then everybody else in that classification will likely also have been found to have been misclassified. And, of course, while the Department of Labor is visiting you, they want to look at your other files and see how you may have misclassified all kinds of other classifications. And let me just say, no good can ever come from a visit of the Department of Labor. That's the general rule. So the consequences can be quite severe. And by the way, since outside sales were last covered, I was just going to say, if you have outside salespeople or any salespeople that you're paying commissions to, that is also something that you need to be very careful about, and that would be a topic of another seminar about the sales commission statute, which is just awful and the pitfalls and how you can avoid it. But there are things that you should have in your salespeople's contracts. In fact, get them out of the commissions and put them in the bonuses. So, do we have any questions, John?
Yep, I think we do have one question, and it's in the sales exemption context. Whose primary role is it at a nursing home location as they are required to sell or obtain intake of residents to fill the nursing home beds? Would that be exempt or non-exempt?
Well, they're working in your own facility, showing the real estate, you know, the empty rooms in the facility. So that's not really outside sales. Outside sales is when you go, for example, you're selling like Hayes Lemur sales wheels to Ford Motor Company, and they spend all their time at the Ford Motor Company, GM, and so on, trying to peddle the product at the customer's location. So trying to sell like a hotel room or a nursing home room, that's not outside sales.
Okay, and we're going to open the lines in a moment here, and I'm going to ask our operator to come on in just a second. I wanted to get one more question in, and this goes back to the creative professionals exemption, and it was a question that came in through our electronic side. How are newer positions like social media specialists being handled under the creative professionals exemption? These would be people that have four-year degrees, create original blogs, tweets, et cetera.
Yeah, they'd have to be original. If it's just, for example, creating a blog and posting links to other people's blogs or articles, that's not creative. Remember, you have to show your artistic flair and be highly creative and original in your work. So under those circumstances, it could be. Tweets, I don't know. Blogs, probably.
All right. At this point, let's open our lines. Our operator, Karina, will come back onto the line and tell you how to ask a question.
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please signal by pressing the star key followed by the digit 1 on your telephone keypad. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Once again, please press star 1 to ask a question. We'll pause for a moment to assemble the queue. And first we'll go to Jennifer Holloway with DRS Services.
Yes, hi. I was unable to actually view the webcast today. I was having technical difficulties, so I have the slides here. So I was just wondering for the org number, if they're putting that up. I can't view that, or if that's something that will be announced.
I'm not sure I followed what you were looking for. The slides for the PowerPoint will be posted along with the entire audio file for this presentation.
Okay, and then the HRCI number, program number?
That'll be sent to you post.
Perfect. Okay, and then I do have another question.
Sure.
You mentioned that LPNs should be classified as non-exempt.
Correct.
Is that even if they're in a managerial role?
No, you can always look at a second exemption. So, you know, they may not qualify as a learned professional, because they don't have a four-year degree as an RN would, but you can always look to see whether they qualify as an executive exempt, that they're managing two or more full-time employees, primary duty is management, and so on.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There's another question that was posted, and I'm trying to read it across the room on a slide. It says something about what steps you should take if a company realizes that they've misclassified individuals as exempt, that they should be non-exempt. This is always a very sticky wicket, because if the employee tends to find out that they've been misclassified, they're going to want all of their payments that they should have been receiving in overtime for the last couple, 3 years, 3 years if it's willful, two if it's not. And so, and they'll probably tell their coworkers too, guess what, I got all this extra money. Here's the way it plays out. The employee goes down to the Department of Labor and complains. The Department of Labor comes out and says, this employee says that you should have been paying them overtime because they think they're non-exempt. You've been treating them as exempt. And they review the job classification. They agree with the employee, and they say, let me see the employee's time records. And then you say, well, they were exempt, so we didn't keep time records. And they'll say, well, the employee says that they've been working a minimum of 30 to 40 hours worth of overtime each and every week for the last 2-3 years. And you'll say, oh, that's not true. And they'll say, prove it. Let me see the time records. And you'll say, but I already told you, we don't have time records. You can't rebut what they've said. The employee's word is gold. And then the next employee will line up and say, oh, yeah, me too. I've been working 30 to 60 hours every week. And whatever kind of story they come up with is basically your liability. And, of course, if it's willful, it's twice that amount and the back pay and so on. So that's kind of the penalty that you have and the problem that you have. And a lot of this depends on the employees at issue. You know your employees better than I do, and so the advice may change from time to time depending on the workplace, the environment, the employees at issue. But one of the things that I've
done, and sometimes this is what I recommend, sometimes I don't, but sometimes I suggest that you go to the employee and say, Joe, you've been working a lot of extra hours, and we just feel like we want to show our appreciation, and so what we'd like to do is start paying you for all of the extra hours that you work. So every week, if you could just turn in your time slip, and we're going to start paying you time and a half for anything that you work over 40, not telling them that you screwed up, not telling them that you could actually be liable for the back pay. And then you start going forward paying them, and then eventually you say, well, we need more specific time records, and you move them into the kind of time records that you're supposed to be keeping. And eventually you kind of ease them into the role of the non-exempt employee. And as every day goes by, another day ticks off on the back end as far as your statute of limitations period goes, and you drop the day of liability. And after 2 to 3 years, you have no back pay liability because the limitations period has passed. So sometimes that's a way of doing it, but you have to be careful.
Let's go back to the phones for our next question.
And again, if you have a question, please press star 1.
If there's nothing on the phone, we do have another electronic question asked by Bob Salter. Does an individual's perspective have any bearing on the status, i.e., if a person wants to be exempt, does that matter? Laura, do you want to tackle that one?
Yes, the answer is a simple no. It doesn't matter what the employee wants or what the employer wants to call it. It goes to the test. It goes to whether they're paid on a salary basis, and then you go to the duties. And another issue that I frequently come across that's sort of in line with that is many, many employers are confused by the salary basis test, and they consider employees that they pay a salary to be exempt, and that those that they pay hourly to be non-exempt. And it's not how you pay them that drives the definition. The definition should drive how you pay them. In other words, you can pay someone a salary that's non-exempt. That's allowed, but it doesn't turn them into an exempt employee. And by the same token, if you have someone whose duties would make them exempt, but you don't pay them a salary, you pay them hourly, they're going to be non-exempt. An exempt employee must be paid a salary. A non-exempt employee can be paid salary or hourly, but either way they get overtime.
Well, there's another question, actually a couple of them. They're very detailed. They talk about accountants with four-year degrees that aren't CPAs and about social workers who have certain bachelor's degrees, but they're not specific and so on. Let me just say this for the people who are still on the line listening. These are very fact-intense questions, highly fact-intense. In fact, that's primarily what drives the answer. And so what I would suggest you do if you have a concern, because I can't just answer a question saying, well, if they do this, you have to really look at what is the employee doing day in and day out? What are their specific duties? And one of the ways to get started on an audit, if you have a concern, is to hand the employee a job description or ask the employee to create a job description if you don't have one. Say, for the next week, I want you to write down every task that you do. And then at the end of the week, look back, you know, kind of keep track of how much time you're spending on it and so on, so that we can put together a job description. And if you have one, give it to them and say, I want you to review this and tell me if you think it's accurate. And if you're doing anything additional, please add to it. And if there's anything that you think that you're not doing that's listed, please cross it off. And then, you know, just sign, you know, write down that when you think it's accurate, say, I think this is now accurate, and sign it and date it and give it back to me. And so what you can do is you can come back, you can take this job description that's turned in, and people tend to puff on their job descriptions when you let them prepare them themselves because they want to be important, maybe it'll result in a raise. And so if you let them puff, they may have said such puffery that will put them into an exempt position to CYA you for your past transgression. But going forward, you say you can sit down with them and say, well, I understand that you say that this is what you're doing, but let's sit down and figure out what your job description should be going forward, and then you modify it back to where you want it to be, and you change their classification in a very gingerly way and say, look, you know, we think we ought to be we want to start paying you overtime, kind of that thing that I said before, giving you extra compensation. Or you can change back their status to non-exempt, but give them a little increase in their take-home so that they're happy campers. But don't underestimate the prestige that comes along with having a salaried position. Eagles are very tied up, and while you would think they would just be happy campers to get more money, a lot of employees would rather be salaried and not keep time records and make a little bit less, which is the darndest thing. But so that's how I would start off by doing an audit. Maybe you can get some evidence that will help you for your past transgressions, and maybe you can get some information to actually do a correct audit and fix things going forward.
Do we have any other voicemail or live questions in our operator queue?
We'll go to Debbie Pomerank with Circuit Control.
Yes, hi. My question is, we have different professional positions that we've classified as exempt, but I know some of the individuals do not have degrees, but yet they have years of experience, and we're classifying those as exempt positions. Is that okay?
Laura, do you want to take that one?
Yeah, it depends, Debbie. Do you think they really fall under, if they fall under professional,
yeah, I think they really do. I mean, some of them are very, like, detailed engineering. They're working on drawings. They're creating different tools and dies. Another would be an accountant. It's not an accountant that does payroll or AP or anything like that.
Okay. It would depend on what their educational background is. Some of it you can.
I would say these people would not necessarily have a degree. They have years of experience in that profession, but not necessarily a degree.
Very few can be grandfathered in. Most require a four-year degree to be a learned profession. That's the general rule. Beyond that,
well, it's not necessarily the position, it's the person.
No, it's the position you always audit, not the person.
Okay.
It's what does the position require, and what does the person have? They both got to match. Again, like I'm an attorney, but you can't take my JD and use me as a greeter at Walmart and say because I have a doctorate degree that I qualify as an exempt employee as a greeter at Walmart.
I would look at it as if we were to hire somebody new in, for the most part, we would look for somebody with a degree, but we might put in there or relevant experience because they may have 20 years of experience doing that particular job or that professional capacity, but they might not have the degree to go along with it.
Yeah, and the job actually has to be one that requires, for entry level, a four-year degree, generally speaking. But we need to move on. We got one last question here in the queue that talks about, are there any guidelines to determine which positions will be paid salary and which hourly? It seems like paying all non-exempt employees on a salaried employee on a salary basis would be the best idea. Wrong. Let me just say this. You can take an hourly employee, a non-exempt employee, and agree to pay them on a salary basis, provided for every hour over 40 they work, you're paying them time and a half because they're non-exempt. You have to pay them the overtime. But by doing so, what you basically have done is you've told this employee, I don't care how few hours you work, even if it's 1 hour that week, I'm guaranteeing you the same salary every week. So, let's say it's $1,000 a week. Show up for 1 hour, I'm paying you on a salary basis, you'll still get that $1,000. Now, if you work 41 hours that week, I'm going to pay you time and a half because that's what the law requires. So you're not getting, there's a trade-off there. Generally speaking, an hourly employee, the trade-off you have is that if they don't work 40 hours, you only pay them for the actual number of hours they work. So why would you guarantee them a salary, guaranteed salary all the time, but still be obligated to pay them time and a half if they work over 40 hours. I mean, it doesn't make sense. So that we need to wrap it up with that question. I think John has some closing remarks.
Right, and thank you, everybody. I just wanted to give a couple closing remarks. First of all, we are going to send out a post-webinar survey, and we're hoping that all of you would just take a couple minutes, just a handful of questions. We really value your feedback, and it helps us prepare for future programs. So we're hoping you take the time to do that. We do have a couple of upcoming events we want to bring to your attention. We've got them up there on the screen. We do have this Informed Employer Webinar Series. So please, if you can, promote this with your colleagues and let them know about them as well. We'd love to have them on the line. We have one coming up in September and one in November. So visit our website, plunkettcooney.com, for the specifics about those programs. We'd love to have you participate on those as well. Last item for you is really the reminder that the audio file for today's program and the PowerPoint slide will be available on our website following the conclusion of the program. We typically get those posted within 24 hours once the audio file is in our possession, so just be patient with us on that. Again, on behalf of Claudia Orr and Laura Dinan and all of us here at Plunkett Cooney, thank you very much for being part of today's program. We hope you found it to be instructional, and we look forward to seeing you down the road.
This does conclude today's conference. We do thank you all for joining us.